I'm sitting here today in sunny England with Susan McCauley, formerly Susan Schaefer. Susan, of the three girls, you were the
middle,
and Priscilla the elder. And I guess process of elimination, that makes Deborah the youngest.
That's right.
Of the three daughters. How old are you when you moved to Switzerland? And just kind of get us a time frame. And then talk to us about Francis and Edith Schaefer is mother and father and husband and wife.
Okay. Well, taking me back to 1948. And I just had my seventh birthday. I was born in 1941. May 28th. So I'd had American kindergarten in first grade. Suddenly there we were, post-war. That had a huge effect on our family. It was very difficult on my mother and father. They had a great burden. They shared this with us children, a sense of mission post-war. We had spent 3 months in Holland on the way to Switzerland, in Scheveningen. We children and my mother were in Scheveningen. It was all bombed out hotels along the seafront. Must have learned quite a bit of Dutch because I always am quite attuned to it. We rode around on bicycles, played. The children we played with had been in concentration camp. Children had my age had starved, and there was still very little food. We also had a post-war diet, so it was quite a mix of never feeling poor and yet actually having very little. My mother had to be very careful, both in Holland and in Switzerland, to take care of us to an entirely different living standard than we had had in St. Louis. And yet they made it seem normal, and we appreciated being in Switzerland. They always shared their love of beauty, for instance, the beautiful mountains, where we were as a sense of privilege. And it was a privilege for them together. There was always a work together on bringing something that they knew was true and good to these Christians and churches throughout Europe who were shattered, some of them crushed beyond belief because of their experiences. We were included in that. My mother was a great storyteller, and my father never belittled his children, it was not heavy, it was never like a lesson. But we had conversations, and we knew how important this was. It was child related. It was never traumatic. But we were in the middle of it, so we were sharing that. Because of this mission, there was this sense of, well, yes, of course, then we don't have a house anymore. So now we're going to live in two bedrooms. And you're going to have all three girls in this one bedroom. You can't really walk around because there's not enough space, but still you'll be able to figure things out. And there's a wash basin. And you can have a bath once a week down the hall. And we have the other bedroom. And from the balcony, we see a beautiful place. For me personally, there is an immediate sense of liberation. My parents they trusted their children to go out and play, disappear for hours out at the back into meadows and cows and explore, and had an imaginary life, a little bit C.S. Lewis-y, making little dens and little people, very like his childhood. And as long as you were back for meals, that was fine. They trusted us to make a huge adjustment. My mother had to do our laundry in that little wash basin in the bedroom, it all, and okay, we'll have church, so we'll push the beds a bit closer together, these two twin beds in my parents' room, and line up enough chairs on one side, and because my father, then my father and my mother both, as parents, felt we were going to lose out being part of a church with Sunday school, and he had started Empire Builders, which was based on his great experiences as a boy in the Boy Scouts and Cubs. So he started that with us there in Lausanne. I still have the book he gave me, Making Promises, doing a few badges. We would, no more car, of course, and we would take our bikes, which they had bought, and they sold the car, go for bicycle rides, off up to places now that are ruined with cars, but in 1948 were still wonderful places. They trusted us to make the adjustment with French. We were put in this little class. Nobody spoke a word of English. We never heard anything in French. And of course, just sink or swim, but it wasn't made to be a problem. That's what you're doing. This is what happens. It just is natural. And actually, we're quite fortunate after the war. We have food. You have shoes. And when I lost my bedroom slippers I needed for school, well, that's going to be your Christmas present. Then you'll have bedroom slippers. That's that's it. A wonderful thing was that there was, back in in Grove City, where I was born, I believe, it was a group of teenagers back when they were first married and started their church, always together, 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 their ministry. My mother had as much a burden and a missionary heart as my dad, but she was also very much a mother. So otherwise, I mean, I personally was very well mothered, if you can say that, all the way through. She was concerned for her children as well as the work. And that's sometimes a difficult balance. It didn't always come out right. But I know looking at my life, it hasn't always come out right. But she related to us in a way that included us. And conversationally, my dad always related to us too, but probably a more stylized masculine. After all, he's born in 1914, isn't he? So that's in the middle of Germantown. Both of them had views on marriage. My mother's view on marriage was the old-fashioned, a lot of people think. The wife is there to serve her husband. There was never any resentment about that. It just is, that's life, that's the way we're made. And then, so if there was a choice between the two, and he was talking to somebody, that was the ministry, there was no question. You know, he goes on doing that, and then she puts the children to bed, whatever. That's the way the family worked. They worked together seamlessly that way, and so it wasn't a great agitation to me personally as a child. It felt okay, it was right. And we also shared the burden. I can speak personally. I'm personally felt included in this delight in seeing fruit from the ministry, praying together for it. Not huge, not hours and hours. We had a good fulfilling like this doing the Boy Scouts or later on in Champerie. They would do on Saturday nights. We had youth group. By this time, I'm 9. My sister, older sister's 13, going on 14 in those next years. My mother make a fun sign. We had a family bulletin board hot dog roast on Saturday night. And she'd make the rolls. They didn't have money. Make everything. We'd make up games. My dad read to us every night. We loved the books. The Secret Garden. All sorts of lovely English books, children's literature. My mother had that in her background because he hadn't, and he loved it as much as we all enjoyed hearing these wonderful books. But he was terribly particular and rather irritating. He'd bring 10 pages. And we'd say, go on, Dad, no, that's it, 10 pages, and then tomorrow night. So Saturday night, They'd arrange things. They thought of us as persons with that kind of need together. My mother, with her generation, born 1914, there was an assumption that we would partake in the chores of the family. So in Champéry especially, not in Lausanne, because we didn't have a kitchen, we didn't have a house. But the next year, so from eight years old on, we had a chalet up in Champéry. And she would be in the kitchen, not the year I was eight, I don't remember that. But from that year on, we grew vegetables, we needed them financially. And if we were on school vacation, we needed to work in the garden for an hour a day, real work. That was always quite serious. And shortly, from say the age of, let's see, so that's 9, 10. From 10 onwards, helping my mother in the kitchen seriously. She would, because she didn't have much money, she would put up in those glass jars, in England we call them kilner jars, to rows and rows of tomatoes when they're inexpensive in the summer, when she could get big trays cheaply from Italy, which was nearby, peaches for treats, baking bread, rolls, chopping vegetables. She was very particular. So sort of a pioneering way. And when a baby was born, my little brother, just assumption, I helped wash diapers, hang them on the line. She taught me to iron when I was 4 years old. I still remember that. And this sense of respect and concern for the great human need for the gospel. They were both real missionaries. Now, she had this gift of hospitality, and she included us in it. So in Champéry, it would be just one or two people, and we enjoyed it. And then later on in Libri, I loved it. There was this sense of, oh, this is so wonderful. And I look back, actually, to my old music teacher in Champéry from the age of about 10, 11. And now, at my age, 75, how I would love to ask her who she was. She had arrived after the war. She was aristocratic, brought an old mother, no money left. And loved to come to our house, and she came to the church services that started in the little chapel. And she had this little chalet that just had room for the grand piano. I think she slept under the piano, and her mother had the one little couch, divan, and she would come for meals. And my parents, I don't know how they did it from their background. It was a gift, but it was also who they were. They were always interested in people, so they didn't have just slogans to give people. We were interested in all these different kinds of people that came. Pastor Guiton stayed with us from Paris, up there in Champéry with his little goatee and his little beret. And I remember him, he wasn't a very good pianist, but he played Beethoven and symphony, pastoral symphony, bits of it, and how all the peasants were coming up. But we enjoyed giving hospitality, and really the kernel of Libri in Champéry, when they started inviting the finishing girls, anybody who reads the Libri story or the tapestry can fit that in, all these things I'm talking about, and the girls would come down. It was a great treat to stay up with them and help make the cakes and serve the tea nicely and light candles and then listen. Oh, we've got two Zoroastrians, princesses from Persia. And yet, but no regarder of persons. All sorts of people in these girls who, just after the war, Switzerland's just starting up, girls, a few girls from England who'd been presented to the Queen. But here they are. And so we're interested, and not just blasting the gospel at them. My father would show these slides that he had taken around Europe. Of course, these girls would have very little things to look at, no television, no movies, no radios or anything. They'd been skiing, and they were delighted to come to somebody's house. The English girls had never had an iced cake because they were still rationing them, I think, in 1956,
yes.
Practically till I came here in 59. So there's this great sense, and when Libri started again, when Prisca brought Grace up from Lausanne, the first weekend. Oh, well, of course you've started the university. Of course you're going to bring a friend home. And that was, and we're happy. I remember helping my mom. There were the packing cases down the hall, and no heat unless we lit a little fire in the stove in the hall, and make it nice. Where's a tablecloth? Mom saying, "Let's have it." And now, oh, they've started a good conversation, so we'll tiptoe in with the dessert. You know, we won't stop this because now he's into a good conversation. That was a big thing, and it was a big lifetime lesson for me. You don't blast a Christian message. You don't know what you're going to say. You're getting to know the person, and suddenly there's this opening, and you're talking about an idea or a situation, and then, well, actually, well, I mean, I'm doing it my way, not my dad's way, but I'm a Christian, actually. And what if Christianity was true? And, you know, so then this is the way it would be. So I believe God created the world, actually. So that would be a different, but you're not attacking the person, you're not saying they're wrong, you know, just an idea you're talking. So you're out in the kitchen. Okay, now the conversation has started. And we look for it, sort of like a murder mystery. Where's it going to go? And we tiptoe back in, help serve, sit down carefully. I'm talking about 14 years old, 15. I didn't go to school because of being at home and with rheumatic fever. So although I was in bed a lot of it, I also, there were months and then other months when I was downstairs and able to be around. And always excited. And then we pray for the people when they went back to Lausanne or where they came from. And the more different they were, the better that was. We'd get these GIs who had never read a book, never had a thought, bless them. And it's all part of the human race. And that is interesting. So they were working together. And now my father would have bits where he would get depressed or feel it's too much. So he'd be sitting on this next floor upstairs because it was such tiny space. These students, now it's time for you to go down, Fran, my mum would say, for the Saturday night discussion. And then he'd say, I'm too tired, I can't go down. Well, Fran. So there was just who told who what, actually. Yes. She had done this, it was all laid out, their city, their fire is crackling. This was later on when there was a fireplace. And now's the time. And then as soon as he saw somebody's face, he forgot about it because he loved people. She loved people. But if they hadn't been for each other, there wouldn't have been. And then she was willing to type for ages, to do all his typing. I mean, the amount of typing that woman must have done, and always on carbon copies and late at night. And they both had phenomenal energy. It wasn't just my dad. They both did. They thought nothing of staying up and working till 2. Dad could be writing and saying she needed to type, but also she, when the cabbages were in from the garden, she'd be making, because for these hot dog roasts every Saturday night, which went from us kids later on, that was always the routine. Saturday nights, the hot dog roast, the students would come up from Lausanne, we'd have a fire, we'd sit around, there'd be a fire, roast hot dog. There had to be relish. She's an American. Unknown in Europe. So she made hot dog rollers, which people don't buy. So we'd spent hours grinding all this cabbage and onions till you thought you were never going to stop crying. And she'd have to mix it in a bathtub and just go on and on. She made different kinds of relish. And then a jam. I was a great jam maker too, but I make jam for them. On and on. So there was this huge sort of industry going on as the numbers grew. And an enjoyment of doing it. And then she sewed beautiful clothes. She was beautiful, as you said. She was a very beautiful woman. But not in an ugly way. Yeah, she was more like an artist. And so were her high teas. She was a perfectionist. In the tray go through the family in different places, but which is wonderful and an artistic. She had a great artistic sense and she had a great sympathy for human need and putting herself second, whether it was her husband, her children, the work, or a human being who came in late.
By the way, did you ever sense your mother was unhappy?
Oh, we all are unhappy sometimes, of course.
But as a rule.
She was a very cheerful person, right into her old age, because I was very close to her in her old age, for months on end. She always loved coming to England, and also in Switzerland. She spent more time, and in the end she ended there. But she always would say, I have these little bubbles of happiness in me, and excitement about things. And she, one of the reasons I love doing things with her, when she came over here, or in the end, when I, down in Lausanne, when she, we had, I had to have her in a wheelchair, was how much she enjoyed everything. And she had shared that. Now, I would also like to say the other great thing they both shared with me, because going back to very early childhood in St. Louis, right the way through all these stages and later on, was an extraordinary reality of a communion and trust in God. And that was a great... gift, ingredient in their relationship. He had come from this different home. She had been brought up on Hudson Taylor. She brought it into our home because then on Sunday nights, we had Christian books read together. Isabel Kuhn from the CIM, or her up with the Lisu. We prayed for missionaries every night, the family prayers. Hudson Taylor, she had worked for, who wrote the, I gave the books here somewhere, Hudson Taylor, the son who wrote the books, the daughter-in-law. My mother was sewing in Philadelphia in their seminary days for her. But it was part of the family, my grandparents. And right now, with the huge explosion of Christianity in China, I think of her mother and father and the legacy of answered prayer. My grandmother's life was saved in the Boxer Rebellion one night in China by Christians who let her down out of a window or something and showed her in Chifu, not Chifu, in Wenzhou. They pronounce it differently now on the BBC and newspapers, Hangzhou, and it's now called the Jerusalem of China, and they're being specially persecuted right now because they are, it is incredibly Christian location. And I think my dear grandparents who suffered so much, and they lost their one little boy out there. My mother's, the baby between my, I had two aunts, again three girls, but before my mother's birth, John was, I called my son Ranald John after him. My grandfather always missed his son, especially my grandfather, Seville. So she had this huge heritage, a faith they had on their wall, framed it somewhere. I don't know who has it, but a check given to the CIM. It was some great key story. Maybe Debbie knows it. Somebody might know it. I don't know it. Sadly, I've been too busy living life, and I didn't go around doing what you're doing, making an archive of it. That would have been good. But we were brought up at God answers prayer. And my mother told us stories of angels. We believed in angels. With these unexpected people, if they were difficult, smelly, difficult, like the post-depression time in America, there were still a lot of men of the road who would land up on their back porch. And she always would make a beautiful tray with a flower and a candle. And he has a mother. Not inside, but, and I'd say, but that's better food than we had. Because she always had to be very, very careful. And they said, what might be in it? Or somebody really inconvenient at the end of those early days in the brain, thinking, I'm going to die of exhaustion. And we've served the food and it's all over. Now I can go to bed. And somebody comes along. Well, maybe an angel unaware. But this is real. So the supernatural for both of them was real. And it was one of the things that Dad, sort of an arrow that got through to people who were being, thinking of Christianity, but as a set theory. Not theory, they would practice it, go to church, sing, but it never broke through into this rather, I think of a French word, frisson, sort of a shiver. There's this supernatural world around us. I think C.S. Lewis had that quite a bit. This sort of surprise by joy. This wonder, which is just beyond and very, very real. So they came at it in a different way, but that was powerful in the home. And in a way, she taught my father this faith and encouraged it all the way through, at great cost to herself, often. Great cost. So you ask if she was unhappy. It is tough. That's a tough life. And anybody who's a pioneering anything, it's tough. And you're balancing sacrifice and not always being wise. We're not, none of us are always wise. We're human and we're sinful, that combination. But actually, she loved the glamour of the life of it. Because she's a writer, and I often thought about this with my mum, and I've written a little bit, and I could have written more. Storytelling is key to a novelist. Your novels, you have a person who sees life around you as a story, and she saw life as a story. She saw her own life as a story. And she liked it. So it fulfilled all these different things, this sort of really worthwhile mission work and serving human beings and the interest of all these different lives, the answers to prayer, her kneeling in the snow, going to Champagne. My dad said, well, we can pack. We'll have to go back to America. I'm just going to go over the mountain and see. She kneels in the snow. Praise. The next day, $1,000. Nobody gave money to us. I have seen in my own life since that happened in different circumstances. Absolutely. And I recognize it. But she was a woman of faith and prayer. And in the hard things of life, where do you go? Like the psalm says, when you go through the valley of Baca, I find the pools of water. And you're fed. She had that. Lifeline. Amy Carmichael came to me and so much to them early on in Le Brie. And I did quite a bit of research once, one winter, for Le Brie and the writing and looking back and writing about it. I don't know whether you've seen that, but anyway, sadly I threw away a lot of the manuscript that was being slimmed down because I think could have been useful, and I used a lot of Amy Carmichael in it. My mother found it, and I forget how she found it, maybe somebody will remember, but before, just as Le Brie was starting, or a bit before, and there were these three people that were their sort of guides, the people who had gone ahead in faith and trust, prayer. And there was George Mueller here in England, and his orphanages, I'm sure you've seen all this. Amy Carmichael, Hudson Taylor, who was also important to Amy Carmichael in her, you look at people and it's being pragmatic, but saying it works. And we're given the Bible with that. And this mystery of prayer, it's a mystery because you believe. But you come and you pray and you believe and you're not quite sure what God's will is going to be, but you see it. And there's answered prayer. And then Amy Carmichael. They really wanted to be a community, but different from Amy Carmichael. The poetry side of Amy Carmichael. And Amy Carmichael was a storyteller. And she writes these beautiful stories. She never wrote a biography, a story of one of the girls, until they had died, because she discovered that they would be under satanic attack. If, you know, once you go into print, that's another factor, actually. I think, yeah, life is tough that way. When you stand up and you're counted behind the parapet, because as my dad always said, there's a battle going on. We knew there was a battle. And there were times when there wasn't the money, there weren't the people. I remember actually my dad and mother saying back there in Malaise, but Le Brie is starting, sometimes we don't have the money, but there's wonderful people coming. Or sometimes there's the people don't seem to be coming, but we've got money. You know, actually this sort of sense of trust. Where shall we go? How is God leading us? Not making a plan ahead, that was their big thing. We don't plan. That's a difficult one. held back. I see it difficult because people do need to make plans about things. But those are my mum and my dad, my dear mother and my dear father.
When you were sitting at the table at mealtime.
Yes.
What's that like? And the reason I ask these questions is because, in a broader sense, I think there are some people who have romanticized the Brie, the life of your mom and dad, that everything was, you know, just perfect. Fireworks every day. And to realize that these were real people,
yeah,
who struggled with a world that's broken.
Mm.
And as you say, things didn't always work out as you had thought they might work out, because life is complicated. It can get very messy.
Yes.
And so you're sitting down at a table and you're having meal as a family. What's it like?
What's it like? Well, there's different eras. What's it like? There was such a huge divide after we moved to Malaz and it's Le Brie's beginning. Yes. That's a huge divide.
Well, start there. Start with after you go.
So I'm going to be 14, and I'm 14. And there are four children in the family. My sister gets down at the University of Lausanne. She's just started. And then...
Can I ask that? Was that difficult for you?
No.
I mean, you've been together, you know. I don't want to let any family secrets. But, you know, I will tell you that I read the tapestry.
Yeah.
And I just remember there's a picture there in the tapestry. It was some kind of a family reunion. And, you know, quite silly, to be honest about it. But I thought, I sure wish I'd been a part of that family.
Oh, silly.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. She's gone down to Lausanne.
Part of the family, you've taken me back to then. I was a nasty little sister. I was a problem to her. I think, very independent, active child. When I was well, I was in do all this, and climbed mountains with my dad. Prisca had left America. She had been an older child in the church in St. Louis. During those 1940s, after I was born, I was born in 41, we left in 48, but she saw the first era of teenagers coming into America. That's when, culturally, sociologically, that's when America got its teenagers, was during the Second World War. She's there, and she sees people, girls are suddenly not children anymore, they're teenagers. And they keep a diary. And she also loved listening to the radio, because the radio, I mean, those were radio days, yes. 1940s. Radio comes up big in my early memories too, but in a different way, just in the kitchen with my mom and music, whereas Prisca wanted to be a teenager. Suddenly, poor child, she's dumped into Europe. It was very hard on her. She was a reader. And for that whole year in Lausanne, now this is a kind of blind spot, not mine, so I'm not going to say all the blind spots of my parents. Who wants to? I'm 75. My kids can be talking to somebody else and telling them all our blind spots. That's fine. Because as you're quite correct, there is no picture-perfect anything. And one of my quarrels with American Christian books and any homeschooling magazines or this, it's the perfect American family. And my daughters who've gone to America say, people, they're different than in England. We are willing to invite our friend, just have friends over for coffee, generally, without having to clean the house first. It seems especially, I'm not quite sure what it is about the States, but you've got to be... come over as this cookie cutter, right? So marriages are like this, educating your child should be like that. I mean, this is the right way to do it. Now, hey, wait a minute. This is not the way it is. But I understand their side now too. Here they are living in two bedrooms, all their stuff is in storage. they had a lot of books with them. We are going to school, and this funny little husband and wife who run a little school down in La Rosière, and so we're not swamped with the public school system, which people were already doing their formal exams. We wouldn't have known what was going on. It wasn't especially kind that way. It was very rigorous, but that was what we were doing. So there are no English books at home for a whole year. I didn't mind being seven because there was always something they could read to us at night. A crazy book, I still remember it. Your body and went through as if there were these little people running through your blood vessels and things. It was most curious. And afterwards, we had wonderful books. I think my mother was fantastic that way, and we'd have this huge range of all kinds of books, never ran out of things to read. But poor old Prisca had that year without books. It was really tough. It was very, very tough for her. And then when she's in Champerie, if you read the book, so this headmaster at the finishing school says, come down, you know, I'll give your daughter a good education for free. And that seemed a wonderful opportunity to my parents. And she'd come home every weekend. And it was, in many ways. A lot of diplomats sent their daughters American. It was international. And they could do American credits. Prisca was in this boys' school where maybe she had picked up a few rough language in French, but we all did. We could call each other terrible names when we did fight as sisters. So Mr. Rangelard says, oh, you know, your daughter should be in a sort of refined place. So that seemed a good idea. But actually, that was a better education to be living in Switzerland. She could have gone on and done all the, as we still have in England, our Cambridge or Oxford board exams. They're not just any old high school exam. So you sit for national exams. And she could have done that. She had a tough time. So here I am, a naughty little sister. You're taking me back to then. And I thought, I am not going to be a teenager. This was back in St. Louis. No. Because I think a lot of sisters are like this. You know, I'm not going to be like my big sister. I'm not going to try to look like this. And then when it came time, I'm not interested in dating anyone. I'm not interested in boys. No. I have my life. So it was just this friction. I will not keep a diary. That's something teenagers do. But she was wonderful to me, taking me back there. Because here I am now, stuck in bed for months at a time, a total of 2 years during those years. From 13 to 17, I had 2 full years in bed. And usually in 2 to 3 month periods. And at that time, it was true what dear old Dr. Coop came to stay with us and see my father. It wasn't just American. I mean, it wasn't just funny Swiss mountain doctors or something. At that time, bed rest, because it could give you heart damage everywhere, anywhere in the world, wherever you were, that you had proper medicine. And it was Chick Coop who put me on penicillin, which was what the Americans were doing. Every single day, penicillin. Anyway, so that was going on. So here I am stuck. And so I have Calvert School. Nobody teaching me. I loved it. I'd started that back in Champerie the last year. I did 8th grade. I was doing 9th grade. Prisca, wonderful big sister. I had a radio by my bed, which was a help. It wasn't much for me to listen to, but there were things. And she brought me books from the university library. She was such a good friend to me. And I was still not very complimentary when she brought my dear, dear brother-in-law, John Sandry, back. The second student to come up when Le Brie was starting. Bless his heart. And, if she's going to have a boyfriend, you know, like that's Priscilla. Although I did take a nice picture of them kneeling together by the fireplace. No, I was okay. I thought, I guess so. I guess you can do this. But yeah, going back to the tables then, if there were people then, their conversation had priority. But we chimed in, and I used to disagree with my father. We'd have real discussion. Different things to say about things. We chime in, and we were meant to be interested. We were meant to think for ourselves. And he was interested and would ask us about French literature and things and what we were reading. Not that I read much in French. My other two sisters went much further with that. I'm reading more in French now than I used to, but because I went on to the University of Lausanne. I decided to. Yeah, I was 17. And I'd done these American courses. After Calvert School, I'd used high school courses from the University of Nebraska, of all places, because that was all there was at that time, correspondent. Then I decided I'm going to leave Switzerland. By that time, I'd been accepted to do OT, occupational therapy, in Oxford. Not in those days in England, not university. Now they're university. But they did different fields like that, had their own colleges. We did have for the medical and anatomy and physiology, etc. We had university professors come up to talk to us, or lecturers, or whoever they were from the medical school. But we were a separate funny little, and living in Headington with C.S. Lewis, going up the same hill, walking when I went punting with my friends in the same meadows there at Magdalene College. I mean, right there, I probably saw the man, probably went past, not far from him. On Headington Lane, yeah. Living in a little hostel for the youngest students. But when I was in Lausanne, we were reading Sartre and Saint-Exupéry, etc., for university. And he would want to, his great thing, and both of them, was to learn. My dad more, he was doing this basic philosophical thinking, analysis thinking. My mother, interested in following it all, very, very with it, always much more on the human and the emotion, seeing the emotional and the human story and the big human picture that you're getting. And be together, amazing perspective to grow up with. Table conversations where the children would run off and play. You see, we had two younger children. Now, Frankie was out of that. Because he's so young. And the younger ones had a very different childhood. So really, but you get a lot of families like this, especially with children, and our own. Our children are, we have six children, four of our own birth children, and then two more who we were guardians, thank God, when they lost their own parents. And so our families were put together, and we have six children. And they've all had hugely different lives. We would have been different stages, different us. I'm different. I became different as a middle-aged person. There's an evolution in our lives, thank the Lord.
Well, in my family, I know what that is, because we actually had three families, if you please. There were two of us, 6 years, two more, another 6 years, and two more. And so
wow.
So you actually almost look like three.
Oh, you
the first
did.
Two are boys, second two are girls, then the last one were boys. And in the interim, just after, I'm going to guess now, just after my eldest sister was born, my dad becomes a Christian.
Wow.
So you insert that
yes.
into this mix.
Yes.
And you see not just the maturing, the formation of people as they get older, but also Christianity now
mm-hmm.
beginning to impact the way the family was organized, what became important in the family, where the values lay, how do we treat one another.
Yes.
And I know that it wasn't perfect. And
yeah.
I'm not suggesting that, but it was different.
Yeah.
And not only was it different, but it was better. Because then the economic change that came, because we had been farmers
uh-huh.
and not a lot of money.
Yeah.
So we didn't know we were. My father would say, still say we weren't poor. I'm just not sure if he remembers it very well. But, you know, we got one pair of boots at Christmas time, and that was
similar,
it.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah, that's your slippers. But then as my mom and dad got older, I think they saw life in a more mature way. I'm not criticizing at all. My dad in the military, World War II, Philippines, how does that impact you?
Yeah.
And how do you see the world?
Yes.
And don't be overly critical of people who came from all that and wanted to be almost isolationist. I don't want to be bothered with anything else. I've had enough terror in my life. So I saw the almost the three families that we had. Yeah.
Well, I think that is just reality. Now, you see, we also had our two, three girls were born in London. We were 6 years and a non-residential Labrie, very different chapter. Mm-hmm. Ranald doing a second degree of theology, first one here in law. And then the third child who went as a baby when we started the were asked to start the residential Labrie at the Manor in about 71, 72. I'm still very young. I'm only about 25 years old, 24. Still college. And then unexpectedly, a second child was born. So I had those two years apart because the others have been 3.5 years apart. So they two, they definitely, it was two and two, the older ones and the younger ones. And much to the relief of our two younger ones who were 14 and 16, suddenly these, Philip and Abby joining us at 3, not quite 4 years old, and just having been 6, not quite 7. Mm. So then suddenly they were older ones, and then there's younger ones, and a similar sort of thing as you've described. For me, what you described about your dad becoming a Christian, and I assume your mother did as well.
Yes.
That watershed that I remember was what my father writes about at the beginning of True Spirituality. I'm 10 years old, and it's very, very, very clear. 10, 11 maybe, very clear the whole winter. And my mother's fear, unrest, where's it going to land? Because he is a person of such integrity. If he goes back to the beginning and feels we've all been just doing it as a mechanism, as kind of, but it's not got this root. It's in the supernatural and real. Where did we have prayer in his evangelical past in the States? Where we just did things and prayed God's blessing. Where were we actually? How was this? Walking by faith is your point. What does it mean to walk by faith and not by sight? And so I remembered afterwards that after he formulated it, what he later on wrote, the first people he gave it to was us, kids. And it was the year we were put out of Champéry, so I am 13. So maybe I'm a bit older when that winter. You'd probably know from the archive. I could look up and see, because my mother would have given a date.
I think it was 50, 51.
Well, I'm only 10 years old, so I'm right. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, that became a huge change. So suddenly, you do the right thing, not so you can give a testimony. Mm. It doesn't matter if anybody sees you do it. You're doing it because it is right. And nobody has to thank you. Nobody has to see it. It was pre-Amy Carmichael's, but she wrote about something very similar when she taught her children to clean behind corners and under beds. You know, the angels are seeing in the corners. But there's another reality. And you do things for people because you love them, or to love our neighbor. If something comes up, this little moment in that conversation, it's a hole in there wanting to either ask or something. That is something to follow. But that was that great watershed. And that was, I saw big differences, but not complete.
Yes.
that purification we hope for be turned into pure gold.
Yeah.
We do not turn into pure gold.
Well, it's marvelous as you relate those things. It certainly resonates with some of the things in my own life. But be that as it may, I think as you talk about, oh, this was a blind spot of your parents. We've all come to that point, haven't we?
Dear God, haven't we? Haven't I?
I remember I was going to go to another country, another state, and I was going to pursue theological education. I was young, and just thinking that, not thinking, that was the problem.
Yeah.
You only just had this one thing, God wants me to do this, and you weren't looking around to realize, what is this doing? You know, how much dust is being blown in the eyes of the folks around me as I'm on a whirlwind tour for Jesus.
Mm.
And I remember, in remembrance, sold all of my daughter's toys. Because we couldn't take them. Well,
yes.
We could have, of course. But what are toys?
Yes.
And you're not thinking like a child.
Mm.
And of course, you know, she's so sweet. She says, no, Daddy, that didn't bother me. I don't know. I'm sure it must have.
Oh, we've done things, which I will not even say here, because the people are too much, still bear the burden of a couple of things. Very similar. Very similar, actually. Yeah, it's just as parents, it's a complicated
thing. Yes.
And the big and little decisions we make as parents, yeah, I'd had such a weird background educationally.
Mm.
This is kind of not a cookie cutter person, like something that fits in anybody's slot. Anybody wanting to do a computer checklist about me can't get it.
Well,
who am I? But so I didn't know much about English education, for instance. You know, in the 60s, and my parents, their philosophy of education very much. They let it go too much. I can see that as their child. But real education happens outside of school, is who you are, with thinking and reading. But going to school is the passport for life. You'll need the bit of paper. Well, it's very difficult when you come from different countries, different cultures, to come into another one. Whether it's themselves or myself individually now, to see, well, how does that translate responsibly,
mm-hmm.
you know, in this bigger picture? What's the common sense thing about this? Not that that should necessarily dictate things, but not even given enough space.
Mm-hmm. So let me just kind of bring this together now. Your childhood was... not a perfect childhood, but a happy childhood.
Oh, I loved it.
Yes.
I wouldn't want to have it.
Yes. And you would say your mom and dad served as good models for how you would then carry on your homemaking.
Well, yes. I think being very real.
Mm-hmm.
Being very real. I mean, I think I'm a feisty person, as you can see. And all of good traits that we have, or see in our children, or other people around us, have an Achilles heel on the other side. Mm-hmm. There's another side of the coin.
Yeah.
So you're a doer, and you do things, important and it's fine-ish. But then you can have a temper that flares up. And I don't think I think that's fairly, if I may use the word, I don't want to use the word normal, but quite common. How to deal with the emotion, and if you think something's right. And so I didn't, I think now, about myself personally. I didn't handle conflict maybe as well. I could respond too quickly with an eruption of emotion. Well, I'm not the only one. And there's always two people involved. You never smoke without a fire.
Yeah.
But I don't think I handled that so well. That's, you know, looking back, like you say. But on the other hand, I'm not so sure about today, everybody having counselling and having anger management either. Because actually, we have to deal with these and we can't dampen it all down or else we're not real people. Mm-hmm. But, so I'm a bit in two ways about it. I think they did awfully well with it.
Well, very difficult circumstances.
Well, also from a... From Germantown, yes. Childhood, from 1914 to 1920, and what Germantown was, I'm now fascinated by these neighborhoods and that side of social and psychological history, fascinating in the United States. And interesting for being outside of it. I'm an outsider. I've never lived there. Mm-hmm. I've not been. I'm not actually American anymore. Mm. But you look at it and you're part of it and you're not. But I just think, wow.
Mm. Yeah.
This is amazing.
Yes, yes.
It's an incredible story of God's mercy and all the good things. They totally, for me personally, dwarf. And the others, anything negative, whether I, you know, then have struggled with it, my own personal life as an adult, looking, I'm now well on the other side. I'm into my last chapter.
Yes.
No,
yes.
Definitely.
Yes.
I'm ready to die. But I'm grateful to be part of that real human race you talked about. Mm-hmm. Not a sort of model of anything. I love literature. Mm-hmm. And love reading the Russian. I like the Russian writers and people. We're part of this human race. We're one of the crowd.
Well, I've appreciated the tapestry. And of course, people can say, well, you when you write, you get a chance to say what you want to say. And, you know, you can just kind of turn a blind eye to the ugly. But I'm not saying, and I don't think that was done. I don't think there was that ugly. I looked at it as I read it, Susan, and I thought, that's a rough way to live. I did. I thought, that's a rough way to live. And as I become older and I want my own space, I want to be able to close the door. Sorry, I just want to be able to close my door. I'd love to have you come over and visit me, but it's 9:00.
Well, we need it. I need it now.
But to live with it, I mean, whatever eruptions, whatever conflict, the fact of the matter is that was a most, if I could, I think, abnormal.
It is. Well,
because
yes. It's one, individual. Yeah. I would say individual. What is normal? Yeah. Is American suburban life normal? Or is English or working class life? Or the sort of what we call public school, which is the privileged.
Yeah.
What is normal? That's not normal, in Swiss terms. So what is normal?
I'm thinking more as we are as individuals, that we, you know, as individuals, we are social, but we also are private.
Yes, we should.
So we need those kind of spaces where each goes on. I grew up in this very small community where I sense, and I've just had this discussion with some folks, I think I have an understanding of what community is. Mm. Community just as community, without Christianity. When you bring Christianity into it, of course it gives it a much richer flavor. But the community that I grew up in was, well, I've not seen anything like it since the days of my growing up.
No.
Except when I go back, and for my summers, and with this I should bring it to a close, but I remember the summer that our granddaughter was with us. Well, she was there with her family. And at one time, she was just a small child. And one day she came to me and she said, Bamboo, why do all these people just stop and walk in? And I said, well, that's just the way it's always been here.
Mm.
But see, she saw that as so different. There, nobody was handing out an invitation. But of course, a lot of it was family. But it wasn't just family, and somebody would just walk up the drive and knock on the door, and whatever you're doing, you stopped, or you might say, let me finish this up, and People concerned about what happened in the other house, not in a busybody way.
No.
In a responsible way.
That's right.
Oh, now so-and-so, they're not home. Now there's a car. I don't recognize that car. I think I should go over and find out, you know, what's going on. Because I have my neighbor.
That's right. Neighbor.
Yes. Well, this has been delightful.
I do want to say one more thing.
Yes.
I wasn't going to, but you brought up the tapestry.
Yes.
And you read it. So yes. Then you look up at the ceiling and you say, yeah, you can see things behind the words. From the point of view of writing and biography, there's been a huge sea change in literature and in biographies, including Christians, and then talk newspapers, journalism. But people now go where myself, born in 1941, our generation, and much more my parents, you knew what went on. So, for instance, in a novel written pre sort of 1960s, you didn't have to spell out the detail of a sexual impropriety.
Yes.
Or, I don't know, all sorts of detail, as if you're a private physician finding out the psychological history of a person who needs help. That's very different. We felt ourselves, well, you can read the Bible, and it indicates incredible complexities.
Yeah.
Or if you're watching a Shakespeare play, a good
Same
Shakespeare
thing.
Play, as it was played, or well played, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and then you see some of these films, and they have to act out the entire sexual scene.
Yes.
Now, the same has happened in, I object, and it's not a Christian thing, actually. I mean, I know enough, and I read reviews of books, but there's been a shift in literature, and it's questionable what this is doing there.
Yes.
And why these people have to be titillated through it. It doesn't have to be a sexual thing. It can be all sorts of nitty-gritty, and it goes into something very nasty. Now, that's especially true with biography and people's lives.
Yes.
There's something called loyalty and respect. And although we ourselves personally can choose who we talk to about certain things in our lives, in the end, thank God, some of it's between us and God, not even our husband or wife, or brother or sister, or closest friend. And I think what Jesus says, and I would like to finish with that, of not judging each other, is key in this, of thinking we will have the last word about somebody and say it's this or that. How do we know? What else went on? None of us can say that. That's why I personally don't write about people. Anyway, that's it. Finito. Thank you. This has been fun, actually.
Thank
I do
you
enjoy
so
being
much.
With you.